Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Svetlana Lavochkina, author of Damned Duchess, published by Whiskey Tit in 2018, and the book had a new edition that was published by Northside Press London in 2022. Svetlana Lavochkina is a Ukrainian-born novelist, poet, and poetry translator, now residing in Leipzig, Germany. Her work has been widely published in the US and Europe, appearing in Agni, New Humanist, Poem, Witness, Stray Light, Circumference, Superstition Review, Fairlight Books, Drunken Boat, and elsewhere. Her novella, Damned Duchess, was chosen runner-up in the Paris Literary Prize, and her critically acclaimed debut novel, Zap, was shortlisted for Tyburn Jones Page Turner Prize London and published in German translation by Voland and Quist. Thank you, Svetlana, for joining me today. And again, I'm very happy that we have this opportunity again to speak about your work.
Many thanks, Natalia, for having me yet another time. And I'm very happy to be anticipating this second conversation. I'm totally unprepared.
That's all right.
See what answers I'll come up with and what intricate questions you have in store for me.
Yeah, sure. Well, Damned Duchess, it's located in Zaporizhia.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And Zaporizhia today is under the constant shelling by Russian troops. And when I was reading the novel or novella, I was permanently thinking about this very intricate connection that, in fact, your book establishes not only between different eras running through the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, but also with the present moment. So just in a couple of words, would you describe the plot of the text? Because it can also be kind of tricky, as some reviews say, it's a very intricate mixture of realism and satire.
Home cities, hometowns are for being found insipid, stupid, unpopular, especially if it is not a capital city where you were born and then abandoned, and only from the distance of decades, you start to yearn back there and see that the abandoned place that you had found very uncool actually teems with history, with fascination, with the events that were portentous for the present. And so it happened with me. Actually, Damned Duchess was to become part in Zap, my novel, my first novel. And when I finished Damned Duchess, and when I finished the novel itself, I saw that Damned Duchess would probably ruin the novel itself, because it bursts with characters, about 30 characters within Dame Duchess, and it is set in a different era. It is set in the 1930s, the Stalin time. And I decided against the better judgment, against my better judgment, what I thought then, and against the numerous advice by my friends to cut Dame Duchess out, to make it live a separate life. I think I wasn't mistaken, after all. Yet, Dame Duchess takes us to a huge megalomaniac construction site, the Dnipro Hess. Stalin thought that hydropower was wonderful, and he was dreaming of a universal grandeur for his contraption, the Soviet Union, whatever the consequences of that might be. Stalin decided to make Zaporozhye the construction site for the huge taming process of the Dnipro River. And this construction site became a state in itself. You know? It had lots of workers, and they needed to be managed. And the construction had to take place and be finished with the means that were not always corresponding to any rules of humanity as we understand it now. So the protagonists are a married couple. The male protagonist is Chaim Katz, a Jew, who is the superintendent of this construction site. He is a baptized Jew, and it was only possible to achieve something career-wise in the Russian Empire, ex-Russian Empire, if you were able to cross the Pale of Settlement, so-called. The Jewish people were not allowed to live in big cities like Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Kiev was allowed because, you know, we were the small sibling and the very, very little loved one. Anyways, Chaim Katz gets baptized, and he pursues his dream. He wanted to become a mechanic and study in Moscow. And so he did that. And because Jews were not treated all that well by the last Russian Tsar, the last Russian Tsar is very often idealized. You know, well, the martyr, yes, he was a martyr. Yes, he and his family perished ignominiously and very cruelly. That's true. But whether this was a wonderful monarch is to be doubted. One of the features of the last Russian Tsar was, anti-Semitism. And this was the explanation why so many Jews believed in the Russian Revolution and thought that the Russian Revolution would bring them freedom and would bring them better treatment. So Chaim Katz became a revolutionary, and he was very successful in it. Because he was a mechanic, he was able to make a big contribution to the blowing up of the world, to fighting in the barricades with gunpowder and stuff like this. So, and because the Russian Revolution abolished all the tables of ranks, yeah? So people were all organized according to ranks. It all became mixed up, and now impossible marriages hitherto became possible. So he marries an ex-duchess, very beautiful young woman, and very desperate, distitled, alive, unlike all her friends and her parents who were killed during the coup. So the marriage is doomed to be unhappy. They have nothing in common yet. They have to go on. She wants to survive. And Daria, as an ex-duchess, is used to a completely different lifestyle than she has to maintain now. She still yearns for the days of her beauty, of her popularity, of wealth. and of course of like male adoration. In the atmosphere of the construction site, love looks different, adoration looks different as well. And because her new lifestyle has not made it possible for her to like it in any way, she's still, well, she yearns back to the days of her like heyday, to when she was beautiful, rich, popular. She cannot return that, but there is an insidious little plan in her head that she at any price would like to put into practice. And for putting into practice this very special plan of returning part of her glorious, glamorous life before the revolution, she uses the help of the males present at the construction site. The way she wields this male power is very dubious. I'm not spoiling anything. Those who wish to read will read. And, well, she has to pay for this enterprise of hers. In this ubiquitous atmosphere of Stalin time purges and the way people treated each other to survive back then. I know, well, there were many reviews, especially in Germany. This short novel, this novella, was translated into German and came out 2 days before the war. Mm. And that made the book a bit better read, probably, than it would have been had the war not started. Also, the publication of this book in Germany made it possible for me to speak a lot about Ukraine in the media and explain about Ukraine, made the people aware of what Ukraine is about and how it is. So, what was I saying? Right. One of the reviews said, well, this is such a woman-hating novella. I doubt I will read anything by this author ever again. which speaks about the way things have changed, right? I think that it was just realistic the way I wrote the novel and the way I the novella and the way I described the treatment of women or like of people at that time anyway. In order to survive, you have to be a bad person. Otherwise, it would have made no sense. You would kick the bucket in 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. So,
Well, there are also classics in this text, and there is this page 24. Let me read out this passage. From generation to generation, the stories of Cossack treasures, custom made for each family, were passed and passed on from father to son in great secret. And the daredevils set off to find the ancestral vaults. Sometimes the Cossacks buried coins, muskets, bejeweled swords in the Dnieper, but the river mass, now raised by the dam, wash them away beyond retrieval. So would you comment on, of course, well, Zaporizhzhia is inseparable from Cossacks, but these references to Ukraine for apparent reasons are quite, if not subtle, but at least they are not as ubiquitous as, for instance, the references to the Soviet Union. There is a very very sensitive, right? Very sensitive reference to the Holodomor. And again, it's kind of subtle. Only probably those who are intimately connected to the history of Ukraine would recognize what the conversation is about. And it's page 94. Thanks to the new law of 5 ears of wheat, there is enough money for health and beauty. The peasants are now allowed to possess no more than a handful of grain after harvesting. Diligent militia and volunteer brigades take care of the law's enforcement. Should a hidden sack be unearthed in a barn, the brigades are authorized to shoot the culprits.
It should be borne in mind that Dame Duchess was written about 10 years ago. In literature, everything is slow. And the way I wrote it then, it was probably, well, because the layers of history are so numerous. And I was concentrating rather on the fate of this particular character, of this woman who actually existed. Of course, I devised everything that had happened to her, but there was such a, presumably, there was such a head of propaganda and a personal manager at the dam, and she hailed from a very noble family. I read that in one of the private blogs written by a descendant of a real construction worker at the dam. So back then, people didn't, well, this construction site was such a melting pot. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the United States of America, I think it's mentioned somewhere in the book. People from all over the ex-Russian Empire came there, partly because they had nowhere to go, partly because they wanted to flee. They had been persecuted for whatever they were and to, like, dive under. And the conditions they lived in were to be portrayed somehow, I cannot say in passing. Well, it is a very graphic paragraph, you know, like money for beauty and money for well-being taken from the peasants. One of the readers told me afterwards that after having read Dame Duchess, she looked up Holodomor and for the first time in her life made herself acquainted with it. So I think it wasn't that much in passing because, well, the style, the way I wrote back then, I don't know, so people, the writers change. And it is difficult for me to judge the style I wrote in back then. It is presupposed that the epoch should be reflected in corresponding diction, in corresponding phrases and ways, yeah? So there is a lot of history and there is a lot of like documentary writing there. It is perceived as satire. It wasn't, because the life conditions, there is a passage about this field canteen that was bought in Germany and that was produced by like Siemens. Yeah? And I read all this from documentary sources about rat meat ratio there and stuff. The Western reader thinks that it's satirical realism or magical realism or whatever it is. It is not. Things were like this. And this anti-utopia was being lived back then. Mm-hmm. And now, when, well, with the war having raged for a year already, I was asked many times if I was foreboding anything, if I can compare Stalin with this Russian rat of a dictator. And I was saying yes. And do you think that this Russian dictator has already reached the proportions of Stalin? Mm-hmm. And I always say yes, he has. Yes, he has. And yeah, all in all. So I, to conclude this sort of comment, I don't know if it is a comment at all, that the layers of cruelty are so manifold and so thick that it probably seems that they are being mentioned in passing, probably the scope of a literary work has but to put these many layers of cruelty one upon another to make this realistic impression of what people in a totalitarian state have been through. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm wondering how you think about time when you write about these topics. We just a couple of months ago we had a conversation about carbon, mm-hmm. and it also revolves around this concepts of time and the individual and history. And mm-hmm. in this book as well, there are very intricate networks that situate the individual right in the middle, right in the center, in the epicenter of the atrocities. But however, the individual is also positioned vis-a-vis some larger temporal dimension, I would say, in your novel.
I know that Nabokov was obsessed with time. And I do not know, well, if this is something I thought I was thinking consciously mm-hmm. about, but we are all set in time, in some time context, and we can only be understood. And the motives of our protagonist, if we write, or our own motives can be only perceived in the context of time, right? If this was a slave-owning society, was it good or bad to have slaves, for example, yeah? If we, in order to survive, have to betray our friends, to denounce our parents in order to survive, are we to be judged? Or should we probably try to put ourselves into the shoes of those people who lived in those times, right? Or the perspective of treating genders, right? The gender fluidity of now, how would it have been perceived by our ancestors? Yeah, such stuff. Yeah, we are inseparable from the time we live in. And probably these time are a little bit like these time frames or these time shackles are definitely something that cannot be disregarded mm-hmm. when trying to understand. Literature is about feelings, probably more than knowledge. However, well, this is a syzygy of both, a symbiosis of both. And literature is about understanding, yeah? It's about trying to get into the shoes of a protagonist. Many protagonists do have prototypes in real life, although to cast a protagonist out of one prototype is almost unrealistic. And what was I saying that for? And well, these real people who give us their flesh, mm-hmm. give us those who write their mm-hmm. flesh, consist of the time they were born in, they were formed in, of the prejudices, of the vices, of the virtues of that particular time. And as said, when writing Dame Duchess, I didn't really think about time. There is one anecdote that, well, it happened like, what, a year and something ago. Because this book contains so many swear words, contains so many pejoratives about Jews, who are very often called kikes, about Roma people who are called gypsies, very, very unethical and, incorrect for our times. And my publisher wanted to make sure it wouldn't run against any court cases. And, well, they asked me for a foreword, why it was that. Yeah, okay, now I'm getting the curve. They asked for a foreword in which I would explain why it is that there are so many bad words in in Dan Dutches. And I was reluctant to do it at first. I said, well, this was the time. This was the time, yeah, that we're talking about. And I tried to explain that in the foreword. And let me just give me a little second. I'll fetch the German version with this prologue.
Mm-hmm.
And this foreword started with something that, for those who did not forebode the war, sounded very military and very aggressive. My translator, the wonderful Diana Feuerbach, said, no, it won't go through, you know, they won't let it through because it's so aggressive. It speaks about bombs. Yeah. 2021 November. Authors are sappers who seek for buried bombs in the soil of memory,
mm-hmm.
something like this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I wrote it in German, this preface. And their goal is not to be mine and sharpened, so to make the bombs safe again.
Mm-hmm.
What do you call it? To demine the whatever, but to make them explode in the reader's heads.
Mm-hmm,
so this
mm-hmm.
was, yeah, this was the preface.
Mm-hmm. But the preface is available only in that German edition.
Sure. It was written specially for the German edition. And further on, it is just a page, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Little more than a page.
Mm-hmm.
No, 2 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Like this and this. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
So, right.
So and you mentioned that you were asked, right, to write this preface.
I was asked, exactly. And I said this was the time. This was mm-hmm. the cruel time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you write a historical novel of any sort, you have to stay true to the language used by those people.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been impossible that, you know, a firing squad would shoot the Roma group saying, Roma ladies and gentlemen, please, would you please stand up? We're going to shoot you now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or if some Jewish person was mm-hmm. despised, he would be called Kaik. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't be called, this Jewish person mm-hmm. annoys me a lot. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be possible. So a history fiction writer has to stay true to the language used
mm-hmm.
in the times where in the times her or his novel mm-hmm. is set in. However painful or disrespectful or blatantly cruel this language may be. Yeah.
And you said that initially you were reluctant, right, to write that preface, mm-hmm. or at least you
I thought it
was not enthusiastic, right?
I wasn't enthusiastic. It's very difficult for me to write nonfiction anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I do this.
Mm-hmm.
And they say it works.
Mm-hmm.
The way but I always write in a very disobedient way.
Mm-hmm.
I disregard all the like rules and the standards of academic writing, for example. So I write as my left foot wants it to.
But on a more general level, do you think that, if we use the language of the time, these prefaces should be written for the audiences, or there are other ways of somehow dealing with this kind of issue?
I think that it is completely legitimate to write a preface like this, because generations change.
Mm-hmm.
And in like my real life, I'm a teacher and I witness generation changes. And they are taking place at a very rapid pace. And the rules of courtesy, the language changes a lot as well. And probably we underestimate the degree of speed, in which concepts of behavior, of civility, of politeness, of self-awareness, how different they have become. I think prefaces work. They should. They should. It is good that times have changed so that it is considered inconceivable to call a person kike in her face, yeah, for example, or, you know, say gypsy. It is wonderful that we're finally thinking about gender, that we're finally thinking about ethnicity. And it only demonstrates that we have at least, you know, gone some way. And I think it is okay to write prefaces, however reluctant I might be. I think it's my private problem that I don't like writing nonfiction. That's it.
Yeah. So Dan Duchess apparently, right, evidently, brings a lot of traumatic events to the surface. And apparently it's some sort of a gesture, right, to get in touch with some traumas that run through generations and generations. Mm. So how would you approach, right, this topic of trauma and this issue of reworking traumas in order to somehow integrate them, but at the same time not to relive them again, so that we could somehow open this possibility not to recreate those traumas again in the present or in the future?
To address the healing of a trauma is, first of all, to name the trauma by its name.
Mm-hmm.
To announce it, to say blatantly what it is. The naming of a trauma is already a step towards healing. It is probably not moral right to judge how war traumas are ever to be overcome, how they are to ever be healed. They will probably not be healed.
Mm-hmm.
The year that has passed has witnessed so many atrocities and has made so many people desperate, incurable, unhappy, that I doubt that overcoming these multiple traumata it might take generations to be overcome. And we have the issue of hatred, which accompanies trauma. And frankly speaking, it is not up to me to speak about it. So traumas of private life are not to be compared with traumas inflicted upon you in the course of war atrocities. I think that poets or writers might contribute to it in ways which are very subtle and very complicated. One thing is writing about the war experience, writing about suffering, writing about survival, or asserting of life, yeah? The way the Ukrainian poets are doing right now, this is one thing. Another thing is writing books, writing novels about trauma, about the war. This can only happen in some future, you know, when the scars have started to heal, when the scars have stopped bleeding, the wounds have stopped bleeding. It is, well, dealing with trauma. Well, in my book here, probably this blatant language, probably this directness, probably this breaking of rules was a way of dealing with the trauma sewn in to the fabric of people born in the Soviet Union. those who loved it while living in the Soviet Union are continuing their way in today's Russia. Yeah, they love to be told what to do. Yeah, I think we talked about it when talking about carbon. Might be, I'm not so sure. The sensitive people who are forced to live in some totalitarian regime, they all suffer without even realizing. They see, they have this cognitive dissonance with what their values are and what it is supposed to be, arguably, and with facts presented as reality and ultimate truth. And if you have never faced anything but that way, that mode of living, you will be traumatized without even knowing it, without being able to name it. And so this is what takes place in them, that is probably. But traumas acquired in a sort of peaceful life, more or less, are not to be compared with war traumas.
At the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned that the book received a lot of attention in Germany, and it was right after the start of the full-scale invasion. And you mentioned that probably it wouldn't have received as much attention if the war hadn't started. So apparently the book received attention because it somehow helped to get in touch, right, with the past of Ukraine and with the, all that very complicated position and relation to the Soviet Union. But I find it quite ironic that the attention that was given to the book was triggered by the war. Why the country remained invisible in many aspects before the war broke out.
Let it be said that there was a precursor to Damn Duchess in Germany, and it was Zap, this novel of mine, and it was published in 2019. I must say that there was attention to this book as well. Not that it was disregarded. There was a very lively discussion about it. I was being invited to lots of readings, and then Corona came. I suppose that the attention might have been bigger. Yet it should be admitted that the onset of war pushed Damn Duchess to like the one of the centers of attention in Germany. Then there has always been a certain fascination with Slavic countries in Germany. There are lots of people culturally interested who find the Slavic languages fascinating, who find them great. Although before the start of the Russian invasion, people didn't so much differentiate between, you know, are Russian and Ukrainian different languages, for example, this stuff. And people were equally fascinated by Ukraine, by Kyiv, by Odessa. Odessa is one of the favorite fetishes of Germans. Those in the know love Odessa, for example. But the same fascination would have been found in speaking about, you know, Russian cities and Poland. And it was sort of diffused. There was no difference for Germans, not much, between Ukraine and Russia. What is different? It was the Soviet Union realm for them, with wonderful culture, with wonderful people, and with this different, mysterious, enigmatic soul of theirs. And the onset of war made it clear that Ukraine and Russia are to be differentiated, that the languages are very different indeed, and that what has been happening in Russia has been largely overlooked. And when asked, oh, how did it come to these atrocities? Well, I said, well, you should have been able to understand the propaganda programs on in Russia since the actually since 2014, this forced propaganda about how bad Ukrainians are and, well, employing all the psychological tricks they are so good at. Yeah, so this did the job. When being a German, yeah, you cannot understand what is going on in a country without an insight, without any insider knowledge. Mm-hmm. So you will overlook it. Yeah. So, as said, now there has been different there has been the separation of Ukraine mm-hmm. from Russia in Western minds, at least, yeah. And this is already a positive phenomenon, right? At the beginning of the war, everybody was so scared. And I remember giving an interview to West German radio, and I was asked, well, what can the West do to relieve the suffering? What can be done? It was March. I said, give weapons, give heavy weapons. And it was live. The journalist was confused, and it wasn't what she wanted to hear. I think it was a he or she, whatever. But the word already flew out, and it was heard. It wasn't like me alone, not at all. But people were speaking about weapons. Mm-hmm. And then many Germans told me that there had been a shift in their minds. They, as pacifists, with this very heavyweight history of fascism, yeah, with the Nazism in their own Third Reich and the overcoming of all that, and they had thought that never again would they be talking about war, would they help anyone with weapons, and they had to rethink their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And they think themselves right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In rethinking that. Yeah.
Yeah, and the phrase that you just mentioned, never again, is very pertinent to your book, Damn Duchess, when we think about the, not the reliving of the Soviet patterns, but at least at this intention to bring up back as much as possible of that quote-unquote glorious Soviet heritage into present lives, particularly in today's Russia. But that's probably also one of the things in which Ukraine and Russia are different, because if the nostalgia for the Soviet Union is really quite overwhelming in Russia, nostalgia for the Soviet Union in Ukraine is far from being what it is in Russia. And this phrase, never again, really gets some new connotations when we think about it in each individual location.
Also, we shouldn't forget, it is a very inconvenient truth, but the tapestry of characters and the tapestry of opinions, both in Ukraine and in Russia, is very, very motley. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, there is the prevailing picture of patriotism and Western-mindedness in Ukraine, right? But I also know of people who do not mind the war to be over, and they don't mind Russia prevailing, mm-hmm. because they just want their peace and they don't mm-hmm. care. And this is actually the layer, this society layer of those who who found Soviet Union not too bad,
mm-hmm.
or who thought, well, at least, you know, we had our secure life and we had food and we had fun. We were not threatened by unemployment. And, you know, the adages that go on with this yearning for Soviet Union. And definitely, the tapestry of opinion in Russia is also not as uniform as it seems to be, that everybody all hails the atrocities in Ukraine. Of course, the no-brains do that, and they are in an absolute majority. But so many people, those I know personally, hold a fist in their pockets, so to say,
mm-hmm.
or help Ukraine actively, having never had any connection to Ukraine whatsoever. This is not to justify the general picture, but never again for them would be never again to return to Russia, for example, if they fled the regime, if they were lucky enough. The never again adage, never again is dangerous because mm-hmm. there is always an mm-hmm. again. If not in a year or two, then in a decade or two, never again. When we were young in the 1990s, we thought, oh, we're a lost generation. We're our wonderful student years. We couldn't even go to a cafe. We had no money for that. We had no money for entertainment. We had scarcely quality food to eat. And it appears from a decades-long perspective that actually, in the context of, if we speak about Russia, the 90s were the happiest time of freedom for Russia. The hungry, no-limit, cruel 90s were happy because people could say what they wanted. And probably this was too much for them. I don't know, for this biomass mm-hmm. who finds it inconvenient to think and form their own opinion. So they are very gullible and they are very prone to have a penchant for dictatorship because it's very convenient.
Mm-hmm.
So, never again. And so there was an again. When I understood that Stalin was being deified and glorified again, it's like, no. You cannot be serious about that, but it was serious, and here we go again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking about the Soviet Union and Soviet lifestyle and cuisine, there is this paragraph about the Olivier salad.
Sick of it. Yeah.
His key idea was to develop a proletarian answer to the Olivier salad, genuinely Soviet, cheap and unprepossessing, but as impressive to a worker's palate as the original had been to noblemen's. He added and subtracted ingredients and counted the costs before the final recipe came to life. 300 sacks of potatoes, 400 bunches of carrots, 500 eggs, the beef of 10 cows, 10 pounds of onions, a keg of pickles, blend with 100 cans of green peas and lubricate all this by drowned glutton mayonnaise. Yes, that was the paragraph that somehow structured for me this kind of very... very bewildering, I would say, bewildering yearning for the Soviet Union. As you also pointed out, many people were happy and many people were able to enjoy their lives, and they didn't care about lack of freedom, or even many of them didn't even think about this lack of freedom as something that could be substantial and meaningful for their life, for their story, right? But in terms of this bewildering again yearning for the Soviet Union, there was a very overbearing amount of atrocities that one would think that, well, right now we wouldn't be even talking about the possibility of somehow reintroducing even some elements of the Soviet Union. However, well, we have something opposite.
And Olivier salad has always been such a fetish, such mm-hmm. a symbol of the Soviet Union. Yeah. I'm sick and tired of Olivier salad. And yes. Last year, somebody wanted to come and whatever, do an interview with me. And this German journalist said, oh, you know, we've read it in your Damn Duchess. In German, it's called the Red Duchess.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, Germans always change the names. And it's okay. Because the word Damn sounds very similar to vowels in German, so it has had to be changed. And he said, oh, well, there is such a wonderful passage about this Olivier salad. Maybe you would make it for us when we come to your place for an interview. I said, I'm sorry, I work too much, and I'm currently heavily taxed with all that. I cannot cut up the salad for you. And whatever. So he didn't insist. But could you, do you know why Olivier salad? Let me remember. It was long ago. Probably it tasted good in my student years.
Yeah. It tasted good. At some point, yes.
Yeah. And then I found out that there was a precursor to it, the noble precursor, so to say. And it contained this kabul soya sauce and those whatever capers and all those noble ingredients. And mind you, 1990s, I had no idea what capers were, what kabul soya sauce was, and stuff like that. That was fascinating. And the view of the before revolution times were a little bit idealized. And I was wondering how it was. And I might have tried to imagine that this translation of the bits of Russian Empire, of something noble, everything sort of good, more or less, that existed in the Soviet Union had been stolen from the cultural layers of the Russian Empire. Or at least the people had enjoyed some education of that sort, or had been to the West and had been world open before. And some very good things came from there, from that ex-openness. And so the translation of this ex-openness, of this French Olivier originally, salad translated for the workers' guts, was something that seemed fitting to me to put into the book. Why I put it into the book 10 years ago, it is difficult to ask writers why they do anything at all. It is the gut feeling, probably. It's not for the writers to analyze what they do. It is intuition, and it fits or it doesn't. I like it or I hate it. Writers are animals mostly. So they sometimes are not responsible for what they write. Not in the academic sense.
Yeah, yeah, good, good. But as I pointed out, that paragraph was some sort of this experience that gives the sensation that, well, that's enough, that's too much. Well, I don't want this anymore. I don't want this heritage anymore.
I don't do this anymore. I don't want this anymore either.
Yeah.
We're on the same page here. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Svetlana, for this conversation today. And thank you so much for your book that really provides this very, very illuminating glimpse into the complexities, into all kinds of complexities of the Soviet Union. And at the same time, it helps to better probably see the repercussions of the absolutely inhuman atrocities that are being repeated by Russia today in Ukraine. Thank you so much.
I have to thank you. Many thanks for having me again, Natalia.
Today I spoke with Svetlana Lavochkina, author of Dem Duchess, published by Whiskey Tit in 2018, and it was reprinted in 2022 by Northside Press, London. Thank you so much for listening to New Books in Literary Studies, the podcast channel on the New Books Network.